Chapter 46. I attend a presidential inauguration. Senators get great seats for presidential inaugurations. Well, we stand actually, but it's in a good spot. Standing just yards from where the new president takes the oath of office, it's a rare opportunity to have a front row seat to history. Except that again, you're standing. When President Obama first took the oath of office in 2009, I, of course, was still in recount limbo. They gave me a decent seat out with the crowd. It was an actual place to sit, which was nice considering that the nearly 2 million other people who had flocked to the National Mall to witness this historic moment had to stand. But it was freezing cold. Plus, I had to get there really early, and by the time the new president gave his address, I couldn't have cared less what he was saying. I just wanted to go inside somewhere and get warm. Anyway, my point is that I was really stoked to have that special senatorial spot to watch Hillary Clinton take the oath of office in 2017. I'd campaigned hard for Hillary, who is the smartest, toughest, hardest-working person I know, with the possible exception of Atul Gawande. She would have been a great president. But after election night, I started looking at the date of January 20th on the calendar with, what's the word, dread. No. Something worse than that. It was really, really bad. I felt like I was looking at my own execution date. And not a relaxing, fun execution by lethal injection, but a horrible, painful execution by a faulty electric chair or being slowly strangled by a piano wire. As the date approached, of course, things just kept getting worse and worse. President-elect Trump made it clear that he had no intention of divesting himself of his business interests. He shrugged off reports by every intelligence agency that his election had been, in part, the product of interference by the Russian government. He installed a white supremacist in the White House as his chief strategist. He also insisted on being a complete jerk. Hillary had graciously conceded the election to him, despite the fact that she had earned nearly 3 million more votes than he had. He couldn't even bring himself to concede the legitimacy of that popular vote. Mind you, no one was saying he couldn't be president if he lost the popular vote. It didn't matter. He could have let it go, but no, he was a sore winner. The president-elect actually insisted that 3 to 5 million votes had been fraudulently cast by illegal immigrants, every single one of them for Hillary Clinton. It was almost as if the incoming commander-in-chief had some sort of mental health problem. The kind of mental health problem that you would be disturbed to discover in your kid's piano teacher, let alone the President of the United States of America. Later, when Trump demanded an investigation into those millions of fraudulent votes, it reminded me of O.J. Simpson, who, after being acquitted of murdering his ex-wife and Ron Goldman, vowed to spend the rest of his life finding the killer or killers. Some 60 House Democrats decided to skip Trump's inaugural. I respected their decision, but I decided to go. The peaceful transfer of power and so on. Standing with my colleagues on the Capitol platform, flanked by fellow Senators Kirsten Gillibrand, a young dynamic Democrat, and Mike Lee, a young dynamic Republican, we passed the 45 minutes before the start of the official program doing what senators do, being convivial and generally enjoying ourselves. I warned Bill Cassidy, the Louisiana Republican, who stood directly in front of and a step down from me, that I very well might vomit the moment Trump said, "So help me God." I don't know what's wrong with me, but for some reason, I had expected that President Trump would use his inaugural address to pivot from the awful, divisive transition to reach out and strike a more lofty, unifying tone. Instead, he had crafted a speech that was just as awful and divisive and so unartful that it seemed he had written it himself in about 20 minutes, or given his attention span, in 40 30-second spurts. His message was that all the people on the platform, except for his family and the rest of his team, had selfishly turned the country into a dark, perilous place, the scene of pretty much nothing but American carnage. After that, things went downhill. Angered by accurate reports that the crowd for his inauguration was smaller than those at the two Obama inaugurals, and the Women's March on Washington the day following his swearing-in, President Trump ordered his spokesman to call a press conference and lie to the media with alternative facts, a new phrase coined by Kellyanne Conway to encourage sales of George Orwell's 1984. After the public learned that President Trump spent actual time calling the National Park Service to insist they release more flattering photographs of the crowds at his inaugural, it began to dawn on many Americans, including a number of my Republican colleagues, that the new leader of our country was indeed unbalanced. By then, of course, it was too late. Donald J. Trump was the president of the United States, and there's a decent chance that he still will be by the time you listen to this book. Even before President Trump took the oath of office, the clear majority of Americans who didn't vote for him, and a growing number of Americans who were really sorry they had voted for him, were trying to figure out how to fight back against him. As it happened, I had had some experience with all this. I'd basically cut my teeth as a political activist in opposition to the Gingrich Revolution, opposition to the growth of the right-wing media, and opposition to the George W. Bush administration. Because I'd been a satirist since I was a teenager, I had had plenty of experience in identifying hypocrisies and absurdities. I knew how to drill down into an argument to find the inconsistencies that would reveal the underlying mendacity of the object of my derision. I had learned not to be afraid to speak truth to power. And that's what my books were about. That's what my radio show was about. That's why I attracted a following of progressives long before I ever ran for office. It's also why, when I did run for office, the transition wasn't always smooth. The tools I'd used to fight for things I believed in as an author and radio host weren't always useful as a candidate, and they aren't always useful as a senator. But they still work sometimes, and I've had a chance to prove it in the early days of the Trump administration. As you will recall, committee hearings are often prime scorn and ridicule opportunities, and the first order of business in the 115th Congress was for the Senate committees to consider President Trump's cabinet nominees, many of whom were, shall we say, ripe for the picking. I mentioned earlier how I confronted Jeff Sessions during his confirmation hearing for Attorney General, where, in addition to busting him for misrepresenting his record, I had the bonus thrill of beating up on Ted Cruz. In his questionnaire, Sessions claimed that he had personally handled four civil rights cases as a U.S. attorney. He hadn't. I proved it. Later, Cruz, in a sort of typically noxious Ted Cruz performance, dishonestly impugned my integrity as well as the integrity of the lawyers who had actually handled those cases. Right before the committee voted, I spent a half an hour taking apart Cruz's bogus attack, which I have to say was immensely gratifying. Meanwhile, the Help Committee was considering the nomination of Tom Price, the Georgia congressman and former orthopedic surgeon, who had spent his career in Congress trying to slash Medicare, destroy Medicaid, and help orthopedic surgeons make as much money as possible. In fact, Price had enriched himself even after leaving his orthopedic surgery practice to serve in Congress, thanks to a series of extremely suspicious investments he made in healthcare stocks while he was writing legislation that affected the value of those stocks, which I delighted in bringing up at his hearing to be Secretary of Health and Human Services. But the moment when I was able to make the biggest impact came during Betsy DeVos's hearing to be Secretary of Education. But this time it wasn't because I asked a tough question. In fact, it was because I asked a very, very easy question. Remember back in the education chapter where I talked about how judging schools by proficiency created all sorts of bad outcomes. The alternative is to judge schools by growth. Instead of measuring how many students reach a certain bar of proficiency, measure how much progress every student has made over the course of the school year. This is a very basic and very important debate in education policy. But when DeVos had come to my office for her pre-hearing courtesy call, my staff and I were surprised to discover that she seemed to have no understanding at all about education policy in general. So I thought it might be fun to ask her at the hearing about growth versus proficiency. In the hearing, I made sure to give her as much context about this issue as possible before asking for her thoughts. She had none. In fact, she had no idea what I was talking about. It was a shocking moment in a hearing full of them. For example, she had no idea that the right of disabled children to a quality education is protected by federal law. And she suggested that schools might want to keep guns around in case of grizzly bear attack. DeVos offered perhaps the worst performance by any cabinet nominee in the history of nomination hearings. And for the first time in American history, the Vice President of the United States had to make the trip down Pennsylvania Avenue to cast a tie-breaking vote on behalf of a cabinet nominee. As one of the 48 Democratic senators in the unique position of serving as a constitutional check on this president, I have opportunities to fight back against this administration that I wouldn't have had as an author and a radio host. But my job also comes with its own set of responsibilities and constraints. I have to be strategic about how to use the considerable but not unlimited leverage I have. I have to coordinate with 47 other Democrats who may have different political realities or even different political philosophies than I do. And I have to remember that the people of Minnesota didn't just send me to Washington to be part of the Democratic caucus. They sent me to Washington to be their senator. Figuring out how to balance all these considerations is never easy. And as someone who's been part of this fight from a number of different perspectives, I've learned that these judgment calls sometimes look different on the inside than they did when I was on the outside. I can't tell you I'll always get it right, but I can tell you this. I'm going to keep fighting it. I'm going to keep fighting as hard as I can in the coming months and years to protect our children, our values, and our future from Donald Trump. And I can tell you this, too. The work people like you are doing on the outside matters a lot on the inside. The Women's March on Washington was one of the most inspiring things I've ever seen. But ever since the march, ordinary people with a ton of passion but limited time, money, and energy have been wrestling with the question, what can I do now? Everyone has to figure that out for themselves, but here's a little perspective from the inside. First, keep showing up and keep speaking out. The Women's March didn't force Trump to resign. It didn't even stop any of his cabinet nominees from going through. But it really, really mattered. It sent a clear message to the president and to Republicans in Congress that the American people won't surrender their rights or their core values without a fight. And it sent a clear message to Democrats that when we stand up to Trump, people will have our backs. Second, keep being a pain in the butt, including to me. Phone calls make a difference. Letters make a difference. Emails make a difference. Coming up and yelling at me in the airport about how Democrats need to learn to message better makes somewhat less of a difference. But showing up in person makes the biggest difference of all. And we've already begun to see huge crowds at town hall meetings held by Republican office holders in very red parts of this country. Unlike the crowds that packed town hall meetings held by Democratic office holders in the summer of 2009, these crowds haven't been badly misinformed by right-wing talk radio and the conservative internet. But I believe they can make just as big of a difference. I never really had any contentious town hall meetings back in 2009, which is not to say I avoided my constituents. It's just that I call these meetings community forums instead of town halls, and the Tea Partiers never seem to crack the code. But my fellow Democrats vividly remember how jarring it was to be confronted like that, and my Republican colleagues are learning the same lesson. Third, become an advocate, by which I mean pick an issue that means a lot to you. Mental health, clean water, immigration, and look for an organization that's doing work on that issue. Join. Give them your email address. Go to meetings. Become a foot soldier. You'd be surprised how quickly foot soldiers in these organizations can become leaders. And you'd be surprised how much senators like me rely on them for information, for advice, and for support. But maybe the most important thing I can convey to you is that you have got to keep your head up. If there's one thing I've learned in my political journey, it's that it can often really be an unpleasant journey. I've had days where being in politics has felt inspiring and gratifying, a rare opportunity to move our country forward and make a positive impact on the lives of millions of people. I've also had days where it's felt like a frustrating, unjust, humiliating crap show. Lately, things have been trending crap show. And while we don't know yet exactly how bad things are going to get under President Trump, I think we should probably be prepared for the worst. The fact is that he is the president, and Republicans control Congress, and that means we're going to lose a lot of fights in the years ahead. Plus, we're going to have to watch Donald Trump be the president, day after day after day, insulting speeches, insane tweets, policies that are both insulting and insane. This is going to suck for a while. But not forever. I still remember vividly how distraught I was after Bush got reelected in 2004. I also remember what came next. I remember how he got up there and declared that he had a mandate to privatize Social Security, and how, even in the midst of our despair, we stopped him, and how winning that fight was the start of something big. I remember how we recognized where our movement needed to grow and change, and how we built progressive infrastructure to make our voices stronger, and how being part of it felt vital and important and fun. I remember how candidates stepped up to run for office all over the country, even in places where Democrats don't often win, and how much energy there was when I would go and campaign for them, and how we started to feel a wave building as the 2006 midterms drew near. I definitely remember how it felt just 2 short years after that, watching President Obama and his family celebrate in that park in Chicago, and how it felt just 8 short months after that, when I finally got the chance to become a senator and help him make a lot of people's lives better. My story, the one you've just finished listening to, is a small part of a bigger story. The story of how progressives picked themselves up off the mat and made an epic comeback. And now we have to do it again. This comeback starts with standing up for our values and making it clear that no president has a mandate to spread bigotry or roll the clock back on progress, especially not one who lost the popular vote by 3 million. It continues through next year, when we have a chance to punish Republicans for enabling this disaster and take back governorships and state legislatures all across the country. That's how we can put a stop to the voter suppression that made such an impact in 2016 and redraw congressional district boundaries more fairly after the 2020 census. Meanwhile, we can hold President Trump accountable for everything he does. And not just that, we can hold accountable every single Republican who enables him, so that when we kick him out, we can kick them out too. There's a part for you to play in the next great progressive comeback story, but only if you can keep from losing your mind or getting so discouraged that you quit before the comeback even begins. Our political system isn't always fair, and it isn't always fun. Being part of it means making difficult compromises and painful sacrifices, For me, it's meant leaving a career I loved so I could be savagely attacked for having had that career in the first place. It meant spending countless hours calling rich people to ask for money. It meant long days of meetings and hearings and long nights of studying my binder to prepare for the next day's meetings and hearings. But even if you don't run for office, in order to be part of determining what our shared future looks like, you have to be willing to give up things like time and energy and money. You have to be willing to tolerate a seemingly endless stream of injustices and disappointments. You have to endure an overwhelming amount of noise and nonsense. And the worst part is, you're not guaranteed a return on your investment. After all, if 313 fewer Minnesotans had voted for me, you'd be listening to a very different book right now, possibly entitled The Bottomless Pit, My Losing Battle to Overcome Depression. That's why, even on the good days, politics is hard. And on the bad days, it can feel downright futile. I've had some of those bad days since I started this journey. Like the day that bestiality ad made my mother-in-law cry. Or the day I had to apologize to Mitch McConnell. Or literally any day since November 8, 2016. But I have a feeling that the worst days of my political career are still ahead. I'm sure there will be moments over the next few years where I'll wish I was back at Saturday Night Live, laughing like crazy in a room full of my best friends, or even just hanging out with my grandkids and giving my brain a break from the constant stream of noise that passes for our political discourse. But I'll tell you this, I'm glad I'm here. And I'm glad you're here, too.